And because we're looking at four chapters, and you're wondering how we're going to get out by 12, as we look at four chapters, we won't be reading the whole thing this morning, but we'll be looking at Genesis 6 through 9 in the very flyby version. You know, Noah and the Ark may be one of the most well-known and most misunderstood of the narratives or stories in the entire Bible. It's very popular, especially for kids. I mean, it's a classic Sunday school type lesson, isn't it? It only makes things worse that we named our son Noah, but I can't tell you how many books and toys and games and all sorts of Noah-related items that we have in our home. And it's very popular. I think it's just the animals is the reason. It's just that it's more like the zoo, Noah and the zoo. And most of these books, I would say, totally miss the entire point of the narrative. And they make it more into Noah and the giant floating petting zoo. And that's kind of what the story ends up being about. Or Noah, the animal match game. You know, like, can you see two giraffes? Can you find the two? Where's the other giraffe? Can you find two elephants? And it just sort of becomes Noah and the petting zoo. But if you think about it, really think about what the story's about, it really shouldn't be your first choice for a kid's story or a kid's storybook. It's like, hey, kids, gather around, and I'll tell you about the time that when God decided to kill everyone and everything. And this is just a warm-hearted thing, and look at all the giraffes and stuff. At Christmas time, when we were back in Ontario, we visited a church, and I had to chuckle when we walked into the kids' nursery, and it was decorated with a Noah theme. Yeah, let's remind the kids about that. But there's just, I guess, cute giraffes and elephants and what have you. But today we're talking about the story of Noah. And for those of us who are only familiar with the Noah and the floating petting zoo version of the story, we may be surprised to find out what this narrative is really all about. And really be maybe surprised by the message that God has for us and how we see Jesus Christ through the story of Noah and this flood. Just some context to remind us from what we talked about, and particularly for those who missed last week. Chapter 2 of Genesis. Adam is put in the garden to protect the garden, to guard the garden, to tend to the garden. God has given him everything he needs to enjoy creation forever, including his beautiful naked wife who he sings love poems to. And then in chapter 3, things go sideways fast, right? The serpent distorts God's truth, and Adam and Eve believe the lies of the serpent and reject the truth of God. And because of their sin, conflict, shame, blame, fear are all introduced into their lives, into their relationships with each other and with God. A curse is introduced. Life will now be painful and difficult and hard. It'll be futile and it'll culminate in death. However, even in the midst of this pain and introducing these consequences, there's also a bit of hope. There's a small measure of grace and hope injected as well. We're told that the offspring or the seed of Eve will crush the serpent's head. The wicked serpent will be defeated. Not really told how, not really told when. We're not really sure what that looks like, but there's just this introduction of hope. There is hope of restoration. Also, God shows this tender mercy to Adam and Eve in making animal skins for them, making garments for them. He sacrifices an animal to cover their shame, which is, again, pointing us to the later sacrifice of Jesus Christ, which will cover our shame and sin. And so we end chapter 3 with a sense of sorrow and loss, and yet a bit of a hope that it may be regained, that what was lost may be found. And as we move to chapter 4, we see how things go from bad to worse. Now, Eve was told in chapter 3, verse 15, that her offspring would crush the serpent's head. And as we discussed last week, this word that we have offspring or could be seed could be used in three ways. It could refer to a direct descendant like Eve's son. It could be or daughter. Or it could refer to an eventual descendant. So some offspring of hers, some individual at some point. Or it could refer to just a generic all offspring of all time. Sort of a generic offspring of Eve. It could be any of these three ways. But it's likely then, although we don't know for sure, but it seems likely that Eve expected that her son, Cain, who's born in the beginning of chapter 4, would be the one to crush the serpent and regain paradise. I think that would be what she was thinking as he's born. So to put it in our terms, she gives birth to Cain and expects Cain would be Jesus. And so you can imagine the horror when her offspring doesn't make things better, but actually makes them worse, right? as Cain kills his brother Abel, there's only four people alive on the earth, and one of them killed another. And we see as we move from chapter 3 to 4, sin is actually grabbing a greater grip on the next generation, not a less grip. Things have gotten worse, not better. And as we move through chapter 4, 5, and 6, we see increasing evil, increasing corruption. With each successive generation, we hope things will get better. Maybe this will be the offspring that will make things right. And in fact, this is the hope that we read about in Genesis 5, verse 28, 29. When Noah is born, his father's name is Lamech. And Lamech names his son Noah, which means rest, saying, this is verse 29 of chapter 5, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief or rest from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. He's saying, maybe my son will bring the rest promised by God. Maybe this will be the one. But instead, with each generation, we see things getting worse and not better. And this brings us to chapter 6. We're going to start in verse 5. Chapter 6, verse 5. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man, whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. In the creation account, the same phrase, the Lord saw, what was very prominent in chapter 1. And back then, it said the Lord saw that everything was good. He kept using that phrase. But now, with the same phraseology, God looks at his creation, and all he sees, instead of goodness, is wickedness, is evil. And we're told that it's only evil intended by our heart. The word is heart in English, but in Hebrew, there's a deeper sense than that. And in fact, we don't really have a good English word, because in the Hebrew mind, the word used here refers to the center of all our thoughts, feelings, emotions, will, morality. It's the center kind of for everything. Like in our Western minds, we've broken those things up. We talk about how he's acting with his heart, or he's following his heart, or he went on his gut, or he was using his mind. Like, we think about our mind is rational and our heart's emotional. We divide these things up and give functions to our organs, right? Where our heart is where our emotions are. Of course, that's not really actually accurate. But in Hebrew, it's all bundled together. The seat and the source of emotions, will, thoughts, feelings, morality, all of those different things are all the same place. And it's actually more closer to kidneys, I believe, which is totally weird. But what he's saying is, it's not just our heart, but it's our heart, mind, feelings, will, volition, all those things, which Hebrew has one word, we use a whole bunch, is only intends evil all the time. All of those things, all of who we are, is directed and inclined towards evil continually. And you notice that God's not okay with this. It actually grieves him. It hurts him. It pains him to see this. He's not cold and objective and just an emotionless judge who approaches it scientifically. It hurts. It causes great grief to him that his beloved humanity, created in his own likeness, and the world he created is suffering under such corruption and evil. He doesn't rejoice at evil. It causes him great pain. So much so that he has to act. He has to do something. He can't just let this corruption increase. He has to step in. He can't watch his world fall apart like this. So we get to verse 9. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God. And Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence, and through them, behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and out with pitch. And we'll stop there. So we learn that the earth is corrupt or spoiled or disfigured. It's badly mangled by sin. And it's filled with violence, it says. Adam and Eve were given the mandate to fill the earth with offspring. And now here in chapter 6, we learn that the earth is not filled with offspring, but with evil, with violence. And the parallel image between filling the earth with offspring and filling the earth with violence gives us this image that violence is procreating violence, which is procreating violence, and it's multiplying on the earth. And it's kind of this frightful image. And then in verse 13, God says that he will destroy. And this is the same word that was used in verse 12. We translated it corrupt then, which is interesting because just as humanity has corrupted the earth, so now God will corrupt it so that it is no longer able to sustain life. Sin is self-destructive. It's a slow suicide. The corruption that destroys the earth, the corruption from sin begins to destroy the earth, and God just takes it to its final consequences of ultimate corruption and destruction. God brings the inevitable corruption to a head. Now, often in the Old Testament, God uses this image of a potter and a clay, especially in the prophets and the Psalms, and God is working like a potter, creating something beautiful. That's the image we get a lot. And often that image is used to tell us that God is sovereign. You know, the clay has no right to tell the potter he's not doing a very good job. That's often how we read that image. But as a potter looks at his clay and works on his clay, as a craftsman looks at his creation, as a seamstress looks at her project, God looks at the creation, looks at what he has made, and he sees that it's spoiled, it's ruined, it's corrupt, it's evil, it's broken. All right? The disease of sin, introduced by the serpent, perpetuated through Adam and Eve, multiplied through their offspring, has entirely corrupted God's good creation. And this is what theologians call total depravity. That's the term they use. Meaning that sin is an unfixable problem, a deep corruption that affects every aspect of life. It's total in the sense that it touches on everything and has an influence on everything. Sin is not limited to one sphere. It's not limited to one part of life, but touches on everything. It's not just one section, but it has a deep effect. It spoils everything. Now, it's important to recognize that sin is not so much an activity as an identity. Okay? So, if sin were just an activity, like, say, bowling, right? Something you do. If sin were just an activity, you could see how you could compartmentalize that, right? So let's say sin was like bowling, where it's an activity that you do at certain times and then you don't do it and you know. So even if you went bowling a lot, maybe if you were in a bowling league, right? So you did this regularly, like every week you went out bowling for a couple hours, and you gave a lot of time to bowling and you spent a lot of time and money on bowling and you loved bowling, but you could probably leave bowling at the bowling alley, right? Just something you did in that designated time. Bowling wouldn't make you a better or worse parent. It wouldn't affect your relationships. It wouldn't affect your judgment or your perspective. It wouldn't distort your worldview. Bowling likely wouldn't introduce much conflict in your relationships, or at least your non-bowling relationships. You know, I think some people think of sin merely as an activity. It can be done once a week and it has no effect on the rest of your week. It can be limited to a couple hours or just that thing over there, and you can just kind of keep it over there and it won't spread in and take over. But sin is not an activity. It's an identity. It's who we are. It's who I am. We are sinners. It affects everything we are and everything we do. It is corrupted and touched on everything. So what will God do? Will he scrap this project altogether? Will he give up on it? Will the potter throw out his clay? Can it be redeemed? These are the questions we ask as we get to the next part of the text. God, the heavenly judge, has examined his earth and found it completely ruined and corrupt. He even pronounces judgment on it. But even in his judgment, there's a measure of grace. There's a little bit of grace. Even while casting sentence, there's an act of mercy. Look down at verse 17 of chapter 6. He says this: "For behold, I will bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall die." Now watch this. "But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you." So God is saying, I will destroy all life, but I will establish my covenant with you. And this is the first time in the Bible that we see this word covenant, berit. It's a very, very significant word, because a covenant is this binding agreement between two parties. A marriage is a covenant where two people come together and make promises and vow and bind themselves together for life. That's what a covenant is. We also have covenant membership here at the church, right? Where this is the church family and an individual make a covenant together. And the individual says, this is what I will do. I will make this my home, and I will be here faithfully, and I will serve here, and I will be part of this family. And the church family says, and we'll take care of you, and we'll provide for you, and we'll love you, and we'll pray for you, and we'll support you, and we'll teach you. And they make a covenant together. It's an agreement between two who bind themselves together in a unique relationship. And God has brought in this covenant with Noah. God is giving his word to Noah. He's binding himself to Noah and his family. So even in the midst of God's judgment, he's graciously initiating covenant, graciously initiating relationship with his broken humanity. Even though the whole project needs to be scrapped and entirely corrupted, God is still working to save a remnant, to bind himself to his people. And the ark is to function as a rescue capsule for God's creation. Humans and animals are represented on the ark as a remnant of God's creation. So though the whole project needs to be scrapped, God wants to save and salvage, redeem, and renew. So Noah hears the word of God, and he's willing to risk his life on it. In fact, Hebrews 11:7 tells us, "By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith." See, Noah believed God's word, and by faith he spends a good portion of a lifetime building a massive ocean liner, huge boat, miles from the ocean. This is either insanity or deep faith. Noah, by faith, builds this ark and obeys God's every word, and God credits it to him as righteousness. God credits it to him as righteousness. So Noah does everything God tells him, and then God sends a remnant of animals into the ark with Noah, and God shuts the door, which is a hugely significant event, in that as God closes the door to the ark, he draws a line between those who are of faith and those who are of sin, those who are under grace and those who are under judgment. God shuts the door, and then God sends rain like we've never seen rain before. Now, we'll go to chapter 7, verse 17, over the page, okay? Verse 17 of chapter 7, we read, "The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep. And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Everything on the dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those who were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. This section is filled with war imagery. We're told that the waters prevailed or triumphed. They have victory over the earth. It's a war image. There's this terrible, chaotic triumph over man and all the living creatures. Just as at the beginning of creation, we read that waters covered the whole earth and chaos prevailed, so too again the earth is covered in chaotic waters. It's the undoing of creation, returning it back to its chaotic state. The one who gave the breath of life deemed it fit to take it away. You see, God hates sin, and he judges it. He cannot stand idly by while humanity and his good creation suffer under the corruption of sin. The righteous and holy God must judge sin. He must step in. He must do something. He judges it while casting Adam and Eve out of paradise. He judges sin as he uncreates the world with his catastrophic flood. He judges sin when he confuses the languages of the people at the Tower of Babel. He judges sin when he completely destroys the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. He judges sin when a generation of Israelites die in the desert instead of entering the Promised Land. He judges sin when his people are captured and deported by the kingdoms of Assyria and Babylon. And finally, God judges sin when he wills the torture and death of his own son, Jesus Christ. He judges sin when he pours his wrath and judgment on Christ for sins that he did not commit. The cross ultimately demonstrates the judgment of God against sin. He takes sin very seriously because it is a serious offense. It is a very, very serious offense against God, and it must be dealt with in a radical way. And so we have the cross. Now, look at the next verse, chapter 8, verse 1. This is the pivot of the whole story. But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark, and God made a wind blow over the earth, and the water subsided. But God remembered Noah. This is the center of the whole chiasm of the story. It's the most important line in the story. But God remembered Noah. It's the turning point. Now, remember in the English language usually means that you've brought back to mind something that you had earlier forgotten, right? So if we think of it that way, it means that God flooded the earth and went, oh, what's that boat? Oh, yeah, Noah, I forgot about you. And then God remembered Noah, right? Oh, yeah, oh, I should help this guy out. He's not doing so well. That's maybe what we'd think of in English as remembered, but that really isn't the sense of the Hebrew word, which indicates acting upon a previous covenant agreement, a covenant partner, acting faithfully to your covenant partner. So God acts on his earlier covenant with Noah, proves himself to be a faithful covenant partner. See, I'll show you where this remembered language is used elsewhere. For instance, in Genesis 19:29, coming up, as we get to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, God's about to destroy these two cities. It says there that in Genesis 19:29, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out. So God remembered his covenant with Abraham, and God was faithful with Abraham and saved Abraham's nephew Lot from judgment and destruction. So God remembering means he's being faithful to his promises and saving. And then in Genesis 30:22, when Jacob's wife Rachel cannot conceive, she desperately wants children, can't have them. She's praying to God and calling out to God. We're told that in Genesis 30:22, God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. So remembering is bringing blessing and answering prayer and is being faithful to his promises that were given earlier. In Exodus 2:24, the people of Israel are enslaved in Egypt, and they cry out to God for rescue. And we're told that God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. So when God remembers, it's not that he forgot, but God is acting faithfully to his previous covenant promises. God is true to his word. God is faithful to what he has intended to do and what he has promised to his people. That's what it means when it says God remembered Noah. God was faithful to his covenant with Noah. So it's not that God forgot, but God is acting with faithfulness to Noah. God is proving himself to be a faithful covenant partner, even if humanity are not faithful covenant partners. Even if he's the only faithful covenant partner in the covenant, God remembered Noah. In the midst of strict judgment and judging of sin, God remembered Noah. God acted faithfully with his covenant partner. So the water recedes as God remembers Noah. And then we get to verse 13, okay? Verse 13. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. The word first is used three times in this verse. It's actually very emphatic. This seems to be the signaling of a recreation. It's a new beginning. It's day one of creation all over again. It's a whole new beginning. And then look at verse 17. God says, bring out with you every living thing that is with you of all flesh, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. And actually, God repeats this later in chapter 9, which we won't look at. But Noah is given the same command that was given to Adam. be fruitful and multiply on the earth. Adam's mandate is re-given to Noah, because Noah is the new Adam in a renewed creation. God is making a new beginning, a fresh start. Okay? Now look at verse 20. This is as Adam, or as Noah, leaves the ark. He leaves, and this is what he does. Verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and took some of every clean animal, and some of every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. This is a very significant part in the text. Noah's first act after stepping on dry ground, first act after emerging from the ark, is to build an altar and to offer a burnt offering, it says. Now later we learn what a burnt offering means. Right now we're not really sure what burnt offering means at this point in the text, this point in the book, in the Bible, in Genesis. But later we learned that a burnt offering is a way of calling upon the Lord, which carried an atoning effect for the worshiper. So a burnt offering is seeking God's forgiveness for sin. It's what a burnt offering is going to mean later. And so a burnt offering acts as a covering for sin. The animal that is burnt up and destroyed is a symbol for the destruction and removing of your sin. And it points to Jesus Christ as the ultimate sacrifice, who bore our sin and bore the wrath of God on the tree, on the cross. All right, so it seems as though what Noah's saying is that he recognizes that God has been merciful and gracious to him. In offering a sacrifice for his sins, Noah seems to be saying, that should have been me at the bottom of the flood. I too should have gone down with the flood. I too deserve judgment. So the first thing he does as he steps on dry ground is make a sacrifice and seek God's forgiveness, to seek a covering for his sin. Noah also should have gone down with the flood, but God has been gracious. God has been merciful to him. Because all sacrifices point to the once for all ultimate sacrifice of Jesus Christ. It's only because of Jesus that we are not, it's only because Jesus was not spared that Noah was spared. It's only because Jesus was not spared that we are spared. We are spared because he was not. Okay? Now, before the flood, God was pained in his heart that the earth was filled with violence and corruption, but now he finds great pleasure in Noah's sacrifice and is pleased. He talks about this pleasing aroma, which is actually a pun on Noah's name. Noah's name means rest, in the sense of like peace and ease, and pleasing. Actually, this word comes from the same word. And so Noah, rest, his sacrifice gives rest to God's restless heart because of the sin. And so his sacrifice pleases God. It has a pleasing aroma, which fulfills his father Lamech's name that he gave him. Lamech hoped that Noah would somehow bring rest from the curse. And God provided rest for the earth by judging evil and washing away corrupt humanity, and in that way brought rest upon the earth. And God provided rest for Noah in not condemning him with the rest of corrupt humanity, but instead covering his sin through an atoning sacrifice, which points us ahead to Jesus. Now, there's something really weird. Notice in verse 21, yeah, it's 21, how the flood doesn't actually change humanity at all. Did you see that? Humanity is just as sinful as ever. The fundamental problem remains. Again, it says, the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. It's just as bad as it was before. It's almost the same wording. Now the question is, why, if humanity's condition has not changed, does God change? Why does he make this promise, never again will I do this? Humanity hasn't changed. It hasn't fixed anything. Humanity is just as broken and corrupt as before. And I think the answer is because the flood shows us what we deserve. The flood demonstrates God's justice and righteousness, and it teaches us the extent of our sin and that we deserve judgment. But God makes a covenant here. He promises that he won't continually treat us as we deserve. See? He won't flood out every generation as they deserve. Maybe he should, but he won't. He won't flood them out as they deserve. God will now work to bring his serpent-crushing kingdom, not from strict judgment, but through grace. Ultimately demonstrated through the sending of his Son. Because judgment won't change sinful hearts. It doesn't make a difference. It doesn't change Noah, as we're going to see in the next chapter. Judgment won't change sinful hearts. We're in too deep. The problem is too deep. We need healing and change that only comes through Jesus Christ. God won't bring about redemption through judgment and law, but through grace and through covenant. He emphasizes this idea of covenant in chapter 9. In verse 8 to 17, he uses the word covenant 7 times, just over and over and over again, about he's introducing this covenant with humanity, and he's not going to judge them with strict judgment anymore to that same extent. He's not going to destroy everyone again, but he's going to be having this covenant with humanity. And the symbol for this covenant is a rainbow, right? A covenant symbol is some sort of physical sign or picture that helps us remember the covenant. So in marriage, our covenant symbol is usually a ring, right? Now, the ring is a symbol for the marriage covenant that reminds us of that covenant, reminds us of the promises made. And in this covenant, God gives a rainbow as a covenant symbol, which is fitting because we don't create rainbows, right? We don't cause them, we don't end them. Rainbows are entirely of God, as is this covenant. And just as the rainbows won't come or go, in that we can't make them go away, we can't lose the symbol, God will keep bringing it in front of us, so too his covenant will not end. It's dependent on him and his grace, not on us and our failings or success. And so the rainbow reminds us, the reason why God has not flooded out my generation is not because I don't deserve that, but because he is gracious, because he is merciful, because he is loving. He responds to my rebellion with grace. He responds to our evil with the cross. That is why we have not been flooded out, because God is gracious. You see, sin is much worse than many of us think. And many of us are unaware of the extent of its corruption and the damaging effect it's had on us. And God is a God of judgment. If he is to maintain his righteous character, he must deal with sin. I mean, what kind of God would he be if he was just totally fine and totally cool with evil? When he just says, well, they can do what they want. It doesn't really matter. What kind of God would that be if he was just okay with corruption and evil and violence? If that didn't bother him, what would that speak of with his character? And so God must judge. He must deal with sin. But even in the midst of that, even in the midst of judging, God is a God of grace and new beginnings of creation and new creation and recreation. And at the cross, we see the perfect intersection of God's perfect justice that punishes sin completely and fairly, and the intersection with his perfect grace and mercy that forgives sinners and brings people into reconciliation. We celebrate the cross because in the cross we see God's judgment and his mercy. God is just in punishing sin fairly and accurately, and God is merciful in forgiving the sinners because of what Jesus has done for us.